last unfinished symphony, and Mahler's youthful song cycle with the lovelorn Wayfaring Lad. And to begin the evening, Hindemith's vivid symphonic picture of a heroic artist. The BBC Proms continue on Wednesday at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
BBC Radio 3 is on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and also online. Just gone 1 o'clock, time for the news from John Shea.
Taliban militants wearing US military uniforms have attacked two NATO bases in eastern Afghanistan. Reports say more than 50 insurgents took part in the assaults in Khost province. Four are thought to have been wearing suicide vests. NATO said its forces, supported by aircraft, had fought off the attacks, killing at least 21 militants and capturing five. But there were no casualties among international or Afghan troops. One of the targets was Camp Chapman, where seven CIA officers were killed in a suicide bomb attack in December. Officials in the Afghan capital, Kabul, say more than 20 students and teachers at a girls' school have been affected by what appears to have been a gas attack. The cause is unknown, but the Taliban are suspected of previous poisoning attacks as part of their drive to prevent women being educated. The United Nations says another 1 million people have been displaced by floods in Pakistan in the past 3 days as the waters of the Indus River surge towards the sea. The river is now in flood at 40 times its normal volume. The largest surge is in the Tata district, not far from the Arabian Sea. Fierce fighting is continuing for a sixth day between government forces and Islamist insurgents in the Somali capital Mogadishu. Medical officials say nearly 100 people have been killed and 220 injured. A team of experts from the American space agency NASA is to travel to Chile next week to give advice on measures to help the group of miners who are trapped underground. A NASA spokesman said the Chilean authorities had asked for guidance on nutritional and psychological issues. The 33 men have already been trapped for 3 weeks, and it could take as long as 4 months to rescue them. The US authorities have given the go-ahead for a merger between the American airlines United and Continental to create the world's largest air carrier. The deal is a response by the companies to the recession and rising oil prices. And the weather, it'll be breezy with sunny spells and scattered showers across much of the UK. The best of the sunshine will be in southwest England and South Wales. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 1:03.
And so to the early music show. And today, Lucy Skeeping looks back to the source of what we might call ballet.
To most of us, the word ballet means a trip to the theatre, yards of white tulle, or the romantic images of Degas' young ballerinas limbering up at the bar under the watchful eye of their dancing master. In earlier times, though, the term was used more broadly to describe a much more multimedia art form, an exclusive entertainment only for the eyes and ears of the very rich and the very mighty. And it was performed not just by well-oiled professionals, but by the aristocrats themselves, the people who paid for it all. In return, the borders between fantasy and reality became blurred. Playing the roles of gods and goddesses who could magically put the world to right was a way for some of the most powerful dynasties in Europe to display their wealth and political strength. In effect, to show who was in charge, and of course the consequences of stepping out of line. So forget the tutus, the point shoes and the leg warmers. The earliest form of dramatic ballet, of dance being used to tell a story, wasn't only a participatory sport for the privileged elite, but also the mother of all PR exercises. And its origin can be traced right back to one specific and extremely significant occasion more than 400 years ago.
Thank you.
On the morning of Sunday, the 15th of October, 1581, the huge salon in the Petit Bourbon Palace within Paris's Louvre complex must have been buzzing with activity. Preparations were well underway for what was to be the climax of a series of lavish court festivities celebrating a royal wedding, the marriage of Queen Louise's sister, Marguerite of Lorraine, to the king's favourite, the Duc de Joyeuse. The performance of Le Ballet Comique de la Reine, or the Queen's Ballet, was due to commence at 10 o'clock that evening, but with so much heavy and elaborate scenery, brand new music and several extremely complex dance routines, not to mention bringing in chairs for, we're told, 10,000 spectators. No doubt musicians, actors, dancers, scene shifters and, of course, the all-important caterers would have been hard at it from the early hours, if not throughout the night. The whole extravaganza was actually the brainchild of King Henri III's mother, Catherine de Medici. In her days as queen consort, she'd been a great patron of the arts. And now, with fewer responsibilities and a disposable income, she could really indulge in her favourite pastime, devising what were called her magnificences. Mock jousts, musical plays, water fetes, torchlight processions, martial arts displays, horse ballets and amazing firework shows. These were the prototypes of the court entertainments that would be mounted a century later by the likes of Louis XIV. And all were intended to keep the nobility out of mischief and promote the court of Henri III as the most culturally refined in all of Europe. For Catherine, though, these shows were not just for the fun of it. They served a political purpose as well, which justified their colossal expense. The truth was, the Valois court was in deep trouble. France at this time was dangerously distracted by wars of religion. The massacre of the Huguenots some 10 years earlier was still fresh in people's minds. And indeed, before the decade was over, King Henri would be assassinated, and the whole Valois line would come to a precipitate ending. It was precisely halfway between these two dramatic events that the Ballet Comique was produced. Its theme was an invocation of cosmic forces to come to the aid of the monarchy, in the form of the classical tale of that evil but seductive sorceress of Greek legend, Circe. In Homer's original, she has a nasty habit of turning men into swine, and here, in this courtly version, she directs her wicked ways towards the King of France. Finally, she's overcome by the gods and peace and harmony are restored. After the entree we've just heard, we find ourselves in a watery scene beneath the waves where we encounter the sirens. Old bearded Triton, god of the oceans, is harnessing his chariot and calling us. Shall we go to him? Go, daughters, tune your voices to his horn and sing the praises of a great king.
Alle Fiel.
The Song of the Sirens from the first intermedi of Le Ballet Comique de la Reine, given in Paris in 1581. The performers there and throughout today's programme are Ensemble Elimar, directed by Gabriel Garrido. The Ballet Comique combined all the arts, music, drama, costumes, sets, stage mechanics, and for the first time, dramatic dance, in the way that it was believed the ancient Greeks had done. It also lasted a good 5 hours, until 3 in the morning, and instead of a conventional stage, the performance space was 3/4 in the round, with freestanding scenery dispersed about. The dramatic action was directed towards the royal party, who were seated at one end of the salon, while everyone else watched from the sides from 2 specially constructed double galleries. After the sirens come the tritons, then a scene featuring a lengthy underwater dialogue about the identity of the nymph who has received sovereign powers above the waves. "And who is this nymph?" they sing. "Is she Venus? No. Is she Juno? No. Her name is Louise, and she has more power than all the names of Juno." Queen Louise must have been delighted with this reference to her greatness, particularly as she'd been personally so involved in producing the show. And she now led the ladies of the court onto the floor where, spread out in strict formation across the huge salon, they began the first dance. It's frustrating that we don't have a record of exactly how the steps looked, but we have been left with a few tantalising glimpses. We know that in the first of 12 dance patterns, there were 6 nymphs abreast in one line across the hall. 3 more were positioned in front of them in a broad triangle, and the same behind. As the music changed, they spiralled in and out amongst each other, their constantly changing configurations brought even more into focus by the colours of their costumes. Circles, squares, spirals and triangles. The whole effect, especially from the galleries above, must have been an amazing visual and kinetic interplay. You'll hear there are punctuations in the music, for a bow or curtsy perhaps, and changes of mood and tempi, which must have coincided with new moves or line formations. Finally, what sounds remarkably like a 16th century gallop brings the first intermedi to a close. The first ballet, ending with the dramatic moment when Circe transforms the dancers into trees. The creative talent behind the Ballet Comique of Queen Louise of France was the Italian-born choreographer Balthazar de Beaujoyeux. Working in Paris for more than 20 years, he'd risen from a mere court violinist to valet de chambre, along the way organising all sorts of unofficial fêtes and entertainments for the royal family. Still, it must have seemed like Christmas had come early when Queen Louise asked him to devise a massive multimedia spectacle for a royal wedding. Once the scale of it all had sunk in, though, Beaujoyeux seems to have suffered from something like a panic attack. As he tells us, after the Queen's request, he took himself off from the noisy court and went into seclusion in order to find peace and freedom of mind. After a few days, he returned to report to the Queen that what she had in mind was just too much for one person, and asked if he could call upon the services of other talented courtiers with specialist skills. A poet to write the text, a painter to create the sets and to write the score, Lambert de Beaulieu, a composer who, like the humanists at the Medici court in Florence, was deeply involved in the business of trying to reconstruct classical Greek drama and music. Beaujoyeux himself would devise the plot, choreograph the dances, and oversee the whole production. Let's return to the plot now, as Mercury appears, intent upon exposing the wicked sorceries of Circe, who, Homer would have been surprised to know, took her nefarious witcheries to the otherwise happy kingdom of France, turning men into animals. It's a strange song, this. Accompanied only by wheezing bowed chords, the lack of bass line adding to the feeling of unearthliness. I am the messenger of the gods. I go to the deep abyss to ravish spirits from the fates, to make them live again. My power shall defeat her arts and expose her sorceries.
Thank you.
I prevented the enchantress Circe from turning Ulysses into a pig. I know of her strength and vigour, but triumph with peril pleases the victor honoured with a powerful enemy. The Song of Mercury from the ballet Comique de la Reine, given at France's royal court in 1581. Plots involving some powerful and malicious sorceress were particularly popular in Renaissance court spectacles. After all, it was a perfect excuse to mix reality with fantasy, that is, for the real monarch to intervene, to restore order and liberate his subjects from the chaos of the enchantress's spell. The whole work, as we've heard, was divided into three parts, or intermedii, and the number three featured constantly in both the symbolism of the characters and in the shape of the choreography. Now, all this reflected the period's obsession with the ancient world, in particular the mathematical and philosophical theories of Pythagoras. Those of us who can recall our school days, fondly or otherwise, might just remember that he was the man who showed us that the square of the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the square on the other two sides. But that was actually just a small part of Mr. P's overall theory of the universe and music, which was based on number and proportionality. As a man of his time, Bourgeoisie was strongly influenced by all this, and what he was trying to achieve in the ballet comique was strictly in accordance with these theories, a perfectly structured, tightly symmetrical, philosophically transcendent marriage of all the arts. So, to the third and final intermedii, the most ambitious and resplendent of them all. It begins with the ethereal Song of the Virtues, in which Prudence and Temperance described how they had each nurtured the great king, the victorious prince, who, they sing, has made France a place of justice and a temple of the law. All very obsequious, and unfortunately very far from the truth. The Song of the Virtues, praising King Henri III of France. The Ballet Comique de la Reine must have been a sensational event, a kind of 16th century equivalent of the opening of the Beijing Olympics, a spectacular, horrendously expensive, all-singing, all-dancing show whose ultimate purpose was frankly political, to impress grandees, not just from France, but from all over Europe. The stage design was particularly elaborate. Four separate areas represented the four elements. Water, you'll remember we encountered the watery sirens earlier on. Earth, the grove of Pan and the disorder of nature. Fire, the abode of the wicked Circe. And air. For this was erected a huge golden canopy, a great vault-like structure representing celestial harmony, in which sat, or perhaps were squeezed, 40 singers and instrumentalists. From on high, then, with a clap of thunder, Jupiter descended from heaven, sitting on an eagle as the choir sung the praises of France. Oh, fortunate heaven, fortunate also is the land under these princes. Fortunate is the ship of France, lighted by its stars. Once safely at floor level, in a very direct, almost conversational aria, Jupiter tells the assembled multitude that he will inspire the king to eradicate the powers of evil, protect France from civil war, and bless Henri with the wisdom to govern. To help you, I come down from heaven. I watch over everything, over the gods in the sky, over restless mortals, and over Hades.
Thank you.
Jupiter's promise of laws that will be just and the people humbly obeisant, from Le Ballet Comique de la Reine of 1581. The event must have been overwhelming for those present, but in a way, even more amazing is the fact that we know so much about it more than 400 years on. Beaujoyeux left his own testimony about the work and its creation, but there are gaps. For instance, at this point, after the appearance of Jupiter, there's a detailed description of the attack on Circe's castle, but no music has survived. Instead, the director of this reconstruction, Gabriel Garrido, has given us something that could have been very similar, a battle piece by the contemporary composer Claude Lejeune. Forward, valiant and dignified warriors in defiance of danger. He who fears death loses his life in despair. Spur on, sound the charge, we march ahead to the enemy. Two, 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 hit them hard and strong. Two, 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 death to all.
From the pearly country, nous qui se bat.
Bataille by Claude Lejeune, a Franco-Flemish court composer of the mid-16th century. His music was heard as part of the royal wedding celebrations, although not in the original Queen's Ballet. Well, the forces of good have triumphed. The castle of the wicked Circe is taken, and guess what? It was all down to the King of France. Dryads, or wood nymphs, now leave their niches in the Grove of Pan and greet naiads who have emerged from the spell of Circe. And the whole scene turns into a grand ballet finale, a sequence of musical set pieces, every bar of which was strictly and geometrically structured. This was Beaujoyeau's representation of cosmic Greek-inspired harmony, social, aesthetic, moral, and of course, political.
Thank you.
La Petite Entrée du Grand Ballet, performed by musicians drawn from the Geneva Centre for Ancient Music, the Lyon Music Conservatoire and Ensemble Elima, directed by Gabriel Garrido. So all's well that ends well, as they say, but that wasn't quite how the Ballet Comique de la Reine would have ended. It may have been approaching 3 a.m. in the Petit Bourbon Palace, but no royal entertainment could have been allowed to close without a final court dance. Again, frustratingly, no music survives for this last section, danced by the king and his entourage. So Gabriel Garrido and his musicians have completed their recording with a series of dances by one of Henri III's leading musicians, Pierre-Francisque Carabel. So let's end the programme with the vision of King Henri, Queen Louise, no doubt very chuffed it had all gone so well, and the rest of the court tripping gracefully, if wearily, to these stately dances.
Thank you.
the Grand Bal de Cour, taken from Gabriel Garrido's recording of Le Ballet Comique de la Rouen. The music was by Carabel, and the performers were the Ensemble Elima. Today's early music show was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced by Chris Wines. This is BBC Radio 3. Now at 2 o'clock, we have another chance to hear last Monday's Proms Chamber Music Concert, presented by Louise Fryer.
Welcome to Cadogan Hall and the sixth of our chamber music proms. Today, a wonderful opportunity to be seduced by some of the richest, most erotic vocal music of the Renaissance, settings of the biblical Song of Songs from composers across the whole breadth of Europe, from the North Sea to the Mediterranean, performed by the young British group Stile Antico. The poem, or collection of poems known as the Song of Songs, is supposed to have been written by King Solomon around 1,000 years before the birth of Christ. The early church promoted its message as an allegory for the love between God and his people. In medieval times, the Virgin Mary was seen to embody the church, and the poem was used in Marian liturgies. But as the poet expounds on the joys and sorrows of his relationship, there's a very human dimension. As far as the physical side goes, he can be pretty frank, with words which, if your Latin's good enough, could make you blush. It's hard to know whether Renaissance composers used the sacred allegory as a cloak to mask setting some pretty earthy texts while getting the church to pay for them. Whichever way, the Canticle of Solomon offers rich pickings. Over the next hour, we'll hear settings from the mid-16th to the early 17th centuries, starting with ones by Clemens Nonpapa, Palestrina, Nicholas Gombert and Orlando de Lassus, with the odd moment of plain chant to allow our pulses to settle. Stile Antico's recording of this music won a gramophone award and was nominated for a Grammy, so it's a real treat to hear it live. Let's welcome the 13 members of Stile Antico.